Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is December 8th, and it's our second to the last meeting. Actually, this is the last lecture is today, and we're going to go over diversification system. Okay, let's look at the schedule. Schedule is on the right-hand side. I'll turn the lights down in just a second. So there's just this one lecture left, and the Monday labs have a practicum today. So the 8 o'clock is done, the 12:55 is yet to accomplish theirs, and then on Wednesday, you have your last exam. And we could say it's your final exam, but it's not cumulative, it's just over those chapters that you see right there, which is, what, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, and 25, which we're going to cover today. So that's it. So I presume all the study guides are there. People know their exempt figures and end of chapter questions and all that kind of stuff. You're good? All right, one more light I'm going to turn off. Okay. Okay. So we're done with urinary system. Anybody have a question on urinary system? I think we're pretty good with that. Make sure you can draw that nephron out, right, and know the three functions that, or the three processes that convert plasma into urine, starting with filtration. All right, so last lecture, let's see. I think at the end of last time I asked you how many sexes are there? How many sexes are there? And people said two. Uh-oh, you're not paying attention very well. And how come there's only two, not three? Or four? I mean, if two's good, four would be twice as good. Do you think? Did you think about that over the weekend? Okay, well, I guess you have to know what the function of the reproductive system is to understand if two sexes are good enough or if we would be better off with three or four sexes or maybe even five different sexes. Okay, does anybody have an idea what the function of the reproductive system is in humans and many other animals? No. Okay. Well, it's... Okay, nobody's interested. Is nobody interested in sex here? We're talking about sex. Come on, you guys. Kind of sleepy. I know you're worried about the practicum and the final exam coming up. Well, all right, here's a little hint. If you look at everybody in class, do you see another you? No. If you were to go to the big football game at the Coliseum or a huge stadium someplace and you looked at everybody in the stadium, would you find another you? Somebody got to tell me. No, you're shaking your head. No, that's good. Go ahead, speak up. All right, well, what would happen if you look at everybody in the whole world? Would you find another you? No, you wouldn't. Very good. So that pretty much tells you what the function of the reproductive system is, and that is to, what, make new and unique people all the time. All right, so if you were to look everywhere, you'd never find another you. If you look in the past and looked at everybody that ever was, there wasn't another you, right? So you're unique and you're new because that's what our reproductive system does. Some animals, when they reproduce, like a hydra, right, all of a sudden a little hydra starts, a hydra is an animal that has a central core with a bunch of tentacles coming off the top of it, just a center tube. When a hydra reproduces, all of a sudden there's like a little bud on the side of the tube, right? And then that little bud gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and all of a sudden it turns into a little hydra. And then that little hydra breaks away from the big animal, and then you have two hydra, one little one and one big one. All right, so we don't reproduce that way, although maybe some of you would like that. All of a sudden you're walking down the sidewalk and you kind of feel maybe your side, and you go, oh, I'm going to have a baby. Right, but that doesn't happen like that in humans, right? Our reproductive system is way too complex, right, for that kind of scenario. Some of us have a penis and a prostate, others have ovaries, fallopian tube, uterus, right? So why is it also complicated? Because that reproductive system is necessary to produce something new and unique. Those two hydra that I just mentioned are exactly the same. So that's what we call asexual reproduction. We reproduce by sexual reproduction. And the beauty of that is that we're all different, right? So we all have specific strengths and weaknesses. And what that means is when there is a really nasty virus, and we could even think of Ebola as an example, which is highly fatal in a lot of people, but will it kill everybody if they become infected? And the answer is no, because we reproduce sexually, because we're all different. There's going to be some people in the population that will be able to fight that infection and live through that infection, and therefore the species will be able to continue as a result of that. All right, so that's the beauty of sexual reproduction. And there's only a couple of diseases that I find really strange, and I think I mentioned this before when we studied bones. What is one pathology that everybody has to be concerned with if you're lucky enough to live long enough for bones? Osteoporosis, that's right. Everybody, if we're lucky to live long enough, we're going to have to deal with osteoporosis, especially women, but it affects men just as well. And that's when we demineralize our bones, because we need calcium for many more important reasons besides just making bones strong. All right, who's got their favorite reason for having proper levels of blood calcium besides bones? Who's got what's another favorite reason of yours? Yeah, muscle contraction. That's right. If you had to choose muscle contraction or strong bones, what would you pick? Muscle contraction. What else? Synaptic transmission requires calcium levels, right? And so that's the way that neurons communicate with each other. So what's more important, having strong bones or a brain that works? Probably a brain that works, right? All right. And also, blood coagulation requires calcium. There's just a couple. All right, so what would be more important, having strong bones, or if you had strong bones, you would bleed to death if you had a little cut. So what's better? And you probably all would agree, it would be good to stop that blood loss. Okay, so calcium, so osteoporosis is one of those strange kind of things that kind of sneaks under the radar, even though we're all different. All right, we're going to look at another thing today with regard to the male reproductive system. All right, well, before we go to the reproductive system, I'm showing you a slide right here, and we see that it has to do with the California Safely Surrender Baby Law. What does that mean? Does anybody know? I hear some talking back there. You guys should listen to this, all right, especially if you're disturbing somebody else. What is this baby safe law, California Safely Surrender Baby Law? Anybody ever hear of this? Raise your hand if you've heard of this before. Well, a couple people have, but a lot of people haven't. All right, so, hey, you guys, yo, this safe haven law just says that, and maybe the law has changed since I picked this up, but it says if you ever deliver a baby within 3 days of birth, if you realize you can't care for it, and you can surrender it to a hospital or fire station or police department, and you'll have no responsibility, no legal responsibility ever again, right? And that baby will be placed in adoption, and there's lots of families that need babies, right? So what this law tries to do is circumvent what happens to babies sometimes when a mom or a dad is just kind of really at their wit's end, and sometimes they actually kill their own babies as a result of that, or they'll leave them someplace and they die, right? So this is a law that helps circumvent that situation. And every year I hear of, right, somebody finding an infant baby someplace that's dead, and probably they haven't heard of this law, right? So go ahead and spread this information around to everybody. Not that you guys would ever kill any of your own babies, but you know, some people just are totally stressed out after parturition, and so this should just be common knowledge. All right, any questions on that? Any questions about the safe haven laws? Probably if you walk into a hospital, emergency room, you'll even see signs. All right, so go ahead, read those signs, and now you know what all those signs are about. And I think 3 days is still good. Some states, it's quite a bit different. Some states even have it maybe for a couple weeks. All right, but it's just a couple days here in California. All right, so reproductive system. Well, we see that we have two sexes, and so the purpose of the reproductive system is to make something new and unique all the time. And since everybody is new and unique, we don't need more than two sexes. Two sexes is plenty, right, because everybody's different anyway. All right, so let's start. Where should we start? Well, we got a choice, male reproductive system or female reproductive system. So, I don't know. What came first, males or females? Well, everybody's the same, males, so I'm going to start with males, right? Okay. That's just kind of a poke at the biblical interpretation, right? That's not necessarily true, but it's an interesting question to ponder. Okay, so the primary reproductive structure in the male, and we're going to find out what it is in the female as well, is the testes, right? And here we see a testes. You know where the testes are. They're located in the scrotum. They're outside the pelvic cavity. And the reason why that is because spermatogenesis only takes place at a lower than normal body temperature. And if the testes is retained in the pelvic cavity, not only does it not produce sperm properly, but it turns cancerous. Right, and so that is a terrible thing, and of course that could be fatal. So the testes have to descend through the inguinal canal into the scrotum where they are cooler. Right, and on this slide, you probably notice, right, you probably see a blue network surrounding a nerve and the vas deferens and probably a red vessel in there as well. And that network of veins is what we call the pampiniform plexus. Because you might be wondering, well, okay, the testes are down here in the scrotum, but it's getting arterial blood from the abdominal cavity, which is at normal body temperature. How come that arterial blood doesn't heat up the testes and turn it cancerous and inhibit spermatogenesis? And that's because there's a really nifty heat exchange mechanism between this network of veins, which carries cool blood, right, because it's coming from the scrotum, and it surrounds the artery, which is high temperature, and guess which way heat goes? Does something go does heat go from cold to hot or hot to cold? Okay, it always goes from hot to cold, so the heat that is in the artery that's going to the testes right here gets cooled down before it gets there by the pampiniform plexus, right? So even that arterial blood reaching the testes is cooled down. All right, so put all of these things together makes up the spermatic cord. All right, so here's the spermatic cord that descends into the scrotum. And so what makes up the spermatic cord? Well, the testicular vein, testicular artery, testicular nerve, and the ductus deferens as well, and even a muscle, a cremaster muscle, right, which surrounds everything. All right, and so that makes the spermatic cord. All right, so the job of the testes right here is twofold. It is to produce sperm. Another way that we could think of a testes is that we could call it a gonad, right? That's just a general name for a reproductive organ that's doing the job of a testes. Ovary would be another example of a gonad. Sometimes they're called orchids as well. Like if somebody has an orchidectomy, what does that mean? That means that they're getting one of their gonads removed. Maybe it's retained in the pelvic cavity. If it's a testes and it's removed, that's called an orchidectomy. Okay, so the functions of the testes: produce sperm, which we talked about, but also produce a male hormone, testosterone. And testosterone is important for the maintenance and production of secondary sex characteristics, and in particular, male secondary sex characteristics, and maybe some behavioral things as well, like sex drive, which is important for procreation and maintenance of the species. Okay, maybe aggressive behavior as well. All right, so let's take a look at the scrotum, and in particular, all right, so here we see the spermatic cord. You can see blood vessels and nerves, and here is the testes. There's a capsule that surrounds the testes, and you can see there's three components to it. There's the tunica vaginalis, and that might be strange for some people to think about, because usually you think of vaginas belonging to female, right? But when we say vaginalis, it just means a tube or a covering of something, right? So the tunica vaginalis is covering the testes, and it has two divisions, and then here's like the serous, it's like a serous membrane, and then here's a space between these two divisions, and that's the cavity of the tunica vaginalis. And then there is another capsule deep to that that has more collagen in it, and that's the Tunica albuginea. It just means a white capsule. And the Tunica actually invaginates or dives deep down into the testes, and it separates different components of the testes out, and these different components are what we call lobes. Inside the lobes, we have the tubules that produce sperm. And in between those tubules, we have cells that secrete testosterone. These tubes are what we call seminiferous tubules. And so there are germ cells inside these that undergo meiosis, that produce new gametes all the time, right? And then they move from the seminiferous tubule through this straight tubule right here at the base of every lobe, right? And then sperm move into the Reedy's testis, and then through this little efferent ductule into the epididymis. So here's the epididymis right here. This is where immature sperm go, where they mature, gain competency, learn how to swim, learn how to fertilize things in this area, that in the epididymis. All right, and then during ejaculation, then these sperm move from the epididymis into the vas deferens, through the inguinal canal, back into the pelvic cavity, and pass by a couple of organs that we're going to look at in just a little bit. All right, I guess we're going to look at it right now, since we talked about all this stuff. All right, so what is a really good exam figure? Ah, here's a really good exam figure. All right, so here is the testes, here's epididymis, here's vas deferens going through the inguinal canal. All right, then coursing over the top of the bladder posteriorly where it joins with the seminal vesicles. Where do I have seminal vesicles? Right here, seminal vesicles. So as sperm is moving through the vas deferens and passing the seminal vesicles, that adds volume to the ejaculate. 60% of the volume of the ejaculate comes from seminal vesicles, and it contains a number of substances. Right? It produces nutrients for sperm because they have a flagellum, and that flagellum is whipping around all the time. And what function does that flagellum play? What does it give to that sperm? The ability? Motility, yeah, to swim around, right? So it needs nutrients. It needs ATP for that flagellum to work. ATP is coming from fructose. That's a sugar, right? And it gets some of that sugar from the seminal vesicles. The seminal vesicles also secrete prostaglandins, which can stimulate contraction of smooth muscle, right, of the uterus in particular, but maybe of some other things as well, like vagina, maybe fallopian tubes. And it contains sperm motility agents, right? So when the sperm are stored in the epididymis, the flagellum aren't whipping around, swimming around. They're just nice and quiet. But when they add that activating agent from the seminal vesicles, that's when they start to swim around. All right, well, that ejaculate is placed in the vagina. And so now we have sperm cells in an organism other than the organism that produced it. So there can be an antibody antigen reaction when that happens, right? So you can reject tissues that don't belong to your body. So there are immunosuppressants that are secreted by the seminal vesicles to make sure that the female doesn't have an immune response to those sperm, right? And so that would inhibit or stop fertilization as well. Right, and when that sperm is placed in the vagina, it can leak right out. So there are coagulation agents that prevent sperm from leaving the vagina, and there's even some pigments, but we're not quite sure what the pigments are, what the function is. I think we know what the pigments are, how to find them. Right, they glow under ultraviolet light, so that's a very nice marker for emission from the seminal vesicles. And here I see the seminal vesicles posterior to the urinary bladder. All right, and then just below the seminal vesicles, we have another gland. This is the prostate gland. It's below the urinary bladder. And there is a duct from the seminal vesicles, which empties ejaculate into the urethra. Right, so the urethra is what? Just a tube from the urinary bladder to the orifice, the urethral orifice. So here is urethra. That part of the urethra that goes through the prostate gland and joins up with the ejaculatory duct is called the prostatic urethra. All right, so the urethra is part of the urinary system. And in the male, the urethra is also part of the reproductive system, right? It's shared by both. You're going to notice in the female, that never happens. Urinary system is always separate from the reproductive system, right? And the prostate, sort of like the seminal vesicle, adds volume to the ejaculate, forms about 30% of the ejaculate. It has a neutralizing solution in it, right? Because normally the urethra, the male urethra, is acidic. The female vagina is acidic. That acidity inhibits infections, in particular bacterial infections, right? But that acidity would then inhibit the sperm. And so that neutralizing solution from the prostate helps the sperm gain motility, whether they're in the male urethra or vagina. There's motility agents, semen coagulants, and then after a period of time, that coagulated semen is liquefied within the vagina. And so there are some things from the prostate gland that slowly liquefy that plug of semen when it's in the vagina, because those sperm have to be released and swim around through the vagina, up through the uterus into a fallopian tube, which we're going to talk about in just a second, and so that they can fertilize an egg. Fertilization, we think, usually takes place in a fallopian tube, right? So not in vagina, not uterus, and every once in a while in some other cavity, like pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity. What do we call that when there's a pregnancy, fertilization and pregnancy in the pelvic cavity? Right, but extra fallopian tube, extra uterine pregnancy, could be abdominal cavity. What do we call that? Ectopic pregnancy, right? So when you hear that term, ectopic pregnancy, what are you thinking? Are you aware of what an ectopic pregnancy is? Probably some of you are. Okay. Is that, it certainly can be a fatal occurrence. Right, so whenever you hear that ectopic pregnancy, kind of a red light and a big bell should go off in your mind. It's a very serious circumstance. All right, but we're not going to talk about it now because males don't have ectopic pregnancies, females do. All right, so that ejaculate then moves through the prostate gland. All right, and then here is another part of the urethra as it goes through the floor of the pelvic cavity. Who knows what that floor of the pelvic cavity is called? Floor of pelvic cavity. I've mentioned it in lab a couple times. Okay. It has kind of a funny name to it, but we use it a lot. It's called the perineum. Perineum, right? That's the floor of all the muscles that make the floor of the pelvic cavity. So as the urethra moves through the perineum, we call it the membranous urethra. Same tube, right? But it's just got a different name when it's going through the floor of the pelvic cavity. But that's okay. Like me, I'm sure you all have more than one name too, right? That's used at different times. And then the urethra moves into the penis, and so then we would call that the penile urethra, but it also moves through some tissue that has a lot of sinusoids, and it's very spongy. It fills up with blood to maintain an erection, so sometimes we would call that the spongy urethra. Spongy urethra and penile urethra is exactly the same, and then that urethra goes all the way to the urethral orifice at the tip of the penis or the glans penis. All right, as it's moving through the spongy urethra, we have one last gland, and that is the bulbourethral gland. Job of bulbourethral gland is secrete mucus into the urethra, and sometimes this happens before ejaculation. And mucus, remember, is a lubricant, but it's also partly made up of proteins. And pretty much any kind of protein will neutralize acids, right? So mucus has these two functions: lubrication and neutralizing acids that are in the male urethra, female vagina. Okay, and also used as a lubricant. So that's the job of the bulbourethral gland. It secretes a very little amount of fluid, between 1 and 5% of the ejaculate. Okay. All right, here is the second kind of anomalous structure, right, that produces pathology, and that is the prostate gland, right? And what sex is affected by disease of the prostate? Only males, right, because only males have a prostate. But if females had a prostate, they'd probably suffer the same kind of consequences, right? Sort of like osteoporosis. If a male is lucky enough to live long enough, this prostate gland grows and grows and grows, and as it grows, it compresses the tissues around it, including the urethra. right? And when the urethra is compressed, then it's very difficult for males to void the urinary bladder. Right? And so that can be really uncomfortable when that happens. Right? But there's, and so we call that, if it's just hypertrophies, but otherwise normal, that's what we call benign prostatic hypertrophy. Right? But it does occlude the urethra right here. But there is a high incidence that that hypertrophic prostate will become cancerous. Right? And then that cancer certainly can become fatal. And so why do I find this very strange? That that hypertrophy and maybe even cancer will affect every male if they live long enough. Why do I find that strange? And why should you find that strange? Because we reproduce sexually. What does that mean? That means we're all different, right? All males are different, and it's just really strange to find a pathology that affects the whole population, right? But in this case, of course, only males. Okay, so that's a very serious disease process and a very serious condition, even if you have a benign enlarged prostate gland. All right, so that's the prostate gland. All right, going into the penis, we see, if you look at this illustration right here, that there are two kinds of erectile tissue in the penis. Right, in the dorsal penis, we have the corpora cavernosa. And here is a section right on midline. There really is no corpus cavernosa right on midline, but it's, look, there are two of them bilaterally right off midline, but they're just drawn in here just so for the purpose that you can see this is the dorsal part of the penis. And then the ventral penis, right, is the corpus spongiosum. And that's part of the penis that the urethra goes through. Both of these are erectile tissues. They fill up with blood, so there's vasodilation that takes place. They fill up with high-pressure blood, and that produces and maintains an erection. Okay, so the two kinds of erectile tissue. Let's look at just another view of the reproductive system. All right, here we got testes, epididymis, vas deferens. We're ignoring some other tubes, right? The sperm move from the testes into the epididymis, and then for ejaculation, enters the pelvic cavity, past the seminal vesicles into the ejaculatory duct, which empties into the prostatic urethra, and passes by the bulbo urethral glands, and then into the penis. All right, so here you can see the two corpora cavernosa, which are lateral, and the corpus spongiosum, and there's only one of them, right, which is medial, and it helps make up the glands, penis as well. All right, so those are erectile tissues. Okay, and I think that's it for the male reproductive system, but I didn't mention one last thing. Some cells of the testes that produce the sperm. All right, so there are cells, there are germ cells. So here's a seminiferous tubule, nice transverse section of a seminiferous tubule. Here are some cells between one seminiferous tubule and another. Right, so there are germ cells that undergo meiosis to produce sperm. There are also some cells that we call Sertoli cells. Sertoli cells help regulate or promote spermatogenesis by giving nutrients to the developing sperm and the germ cells. Right, so Sertoli cells support spermatogenesis. There are cells which we call interstitial cells, and they have another name. Sometimes they're called cells of Leydig or Leydig cells, and these produce testosterone. Right, so they're in between the seminiferous tubules, so I'm pointing to them right here. That testosterone is necessary to support those Sertoli cells and also the germ cells during meiosis. Right, so there is certainly a lot of communication between these two cells. Without testosterone, the Sertoli cells won't do the job, and spermatogenesis won't take place either. As a matter of fact, the whole testes might regress when that happens. All right, so those are the two kinds of cells. Where do I have that in your list over here? Sertoli cells support spermatogenesis, right? Then we have the germ cells, and then the cells of Leydig, which secrete testosterone. All right, so I think these are good things just for you to memorize. What kind of cell in the testes secretes testosterone? The Sertoli cell? No. Germ cell? No. It's a Leydig cell, or what? The interstitial cells. Interstitial means, what does interstitial mean? It's between the seminiferous tubules, right? Cells between the seminiferous tubules. Okay. And so that production of sperm happened throughout the whole lifespan of a male. All right, so we call that gametogenesis. Gametogenesis takes place every day in the males. Certainly slows down as a male gets older, but it's a process that happens all the time. And I have no idea how many sperm a male produces in his lifetime. I don't know if it's billions or trillions, but it's a huge, huge number. It happens every day. All right, any questions on the male reproductive system? Male reproductive system? Okay, okay, I guess one last thing. What nervous system controls the autonomic functions of your body, like ejaculation and erection, heart rate? What kind of nervous system do we have? Sympathetic. That's true. That's part of it. What's another part? Parasympathetic, right? So sympathetic and parasympathetic, right, are two divisions of the autonomic nervous system, right? So that's what I was looking for. What do you usually think of the relationship between the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system is? Yeah, antagonistic, right? So one will speed up the heart, the other will slow it down, okay? One, it's for reproduction, it's not quite antagonistic. So let me go back to this figure right here. Okay, here they are cooperative. Right, so the parasympathetic nervous system is responsible for erection, right, and the sympathetic nervous system is responsible for ejaculation. Right, so in that sense, ejaculation and erection are not antagonistic to each other, they are cooperative with each other. Right, so here is an exception to that rule, so it's always good to have an idea of an exception to all of these rules. Okay, all right, so that's the last thing about the male reproductive system. Female reproductive system, primary reproductive structure, what would you guess? What's the primary reproductive structure? The ovaries, right? And just like in the male, the ovaries are responsible for producing gametes, which we don't call sperm, we call those eggs or oocytes, and to secrete hormones. Okay, so let's look over here. Where's a really nice view of female reproductive system? Probably I'm looking for a nice sagittal section or coronal section. Okay, so here's a nice sagittal section of the female reproductive tract. So here's that primary reproductive structure, the ovary, which is responsible for producing oocytes, right? But that doesn't happen every single day, right? Most of the oocytes are produced before birth takes place, right? And then after that, right, so they're kind of held in suspended animation, and then after puberty, one of those unmature oocytes matures, and then once a month, usually one oocyte is ovulated from the ovary, at least during reproductive years. So I think a woman is born with about 2 million potential egg cells. All right. So I know some people might be a little disappointed that males can produce gametes their whole lifetime, but females only produce gametes before they're born. Right, but that's not such a big deal because you're born with the ability to make, what, 2 million of them. And I don't know anybody that would like 2 million kids anyway, right? So that's not such a big deal. All right, but by the time, there's some attrition, so by the time you reach puberty, you're left with less than a million egg cells, right? And it declines then over the rest of your life. All right, so job of ovary is to produce those gametes, which we call oocytes, as well as producing hormones. Now, the female produces two hormones, and the male is left out. The male only produces how many sex hormones? Only one, testosterone. The two sex steroids or hormones produced by the ovaries are estrogen and progesterone, right? And those two are necessary to control the reproductive cycle, and we're going to talk about those in a little bit. Not right now, right? But just remember progesterone and estrogen, and you should feel sorry for guys because they only have testosterone. They don't have some counterpart to testosterone. All right. So, ovulation, then an egg gets expelled from an ovary, and that oocyte then, okay, is just outside the ovary. And what do you know about the structure of an egg compared to the structure of a sperm? There's some major differences, major difference, especially if we were to look at surface specialization, specializations on the surface of those cells. Anybody remember? I think we talked about this way back at the beginning of class, right? Sperm have flagella. What are a flagellum, one of them? What about an oocyte? What about an egg after it's ovulated? Does it have a flagellum? And the answer is, well, I haven't really studied it, but the answer is no, right? So an oocyte or an egg doesn't have the ability to swim around, right? But you see that it's got to make this transit through the pelvic cavity into the fallopian tube into the uterus. So how does it know to move down into the uterus through the fallopian tube because it doesn't have a flagellum? Well, that's because this fimbriated edge, which looks like a bunch of fingers on the opening of the fallopian tube, the lining of the fallopian tube, also has a ciliated epithelium. All right, so what can you tell me about the function of cilia in just one word? Motility, right? So even an oocyte can't move, but since the cilia are sweeping toward the uterus, that oocyte gets trapped in that flow, right, of fluid, peritoneal fluid, and then it just goes along for the ride. All right, so what does that mean? Well, that has some clinical significance because those ciliated cells can be damaged, right, by any kind of pelvic inflammatory disease, can damage those ciliated epithelium, and when they're damaged, right, they don't beat, what happens to that egg cell? It doesn't make its way to the uterus, right? That egg cell, right, maybe isn't captured by the fallopian tube, can wander around inside the pelvic cavity or maybe up into the abdominal cavity, and what's there to meet them under certain circumstances? How about those sperm, right? Those sperm can swim around in any kind of watery environment. So sperm swim from the vagina through the cervical canal into the uterus, right, into the fallopian tube, which normally is where fertilization takes place, out the fallopian tube, and sperm swim around everywhere in the pelvic cavity and abdominal cavity. And if they run into an oocyte in those locations, fertilization can take place. And then that fertilized egg will try to implant into mesentery, right, or maybe the wall of an intestine or the wall of a fallopian tube, or maybe it's stuck in the fallopian tube, right? But think of mesentery. What have you seen in lab for mesentery? Is it a big, strong, muscular structure, or was it really thin and delicate? Really thin and delicate. You could look right through it. You could see blood vessels, right? So implantation can take place in mesentery, and there's enough nutrients and oxygen for that fertilized embryo to start growing. But once that fertilized embryo reaches a certain size, it's way too heavy and it rips away from the mesentery, and that produces a hemorrhage, and it can be a massive hemorrhage, which is fatal, right, in just a few minutes. So that's why that ectopic pregnancy is so dangerous. So ectopic pregnancy just means any kind of pregnancy that's not in the normal location. And where is the normal location? The uterus, all right? And you can appreciate, right, that because of the layers of the uterus, that the uterus is tremendously strong because of the myometrium, the muscle wall of the uterus. That can maintain a pregnancy. You don't have a myometrium in the fallopian tube, so if implantation takes place here, that can be fatal as well. So anybody with a history of pelvic inflammatory disease is at a high risk of ectopic pregnancy. So you should kind of always be aware of that. And that used to be really dangerous. It was misdiagnosed many times and probably could be misdiagnosed today pretty easily. All right, so how is it misdiagnosed? Well, if a woman shows up in the emergency room with pelvic or abdominal pain. Sometimes they try to see if it's maybe a kidney stone or maybe appendicitis or there's some kind of inflammation of the large intestine, right? And all those things are ruled out. And then a woman is told to go home, maybe take an aspirin, and if you still have that pain in the morning, then come back and see us, right? And sometimes what happens is the woman never makes it to the next day, right? If that implantation rips away from mesentery, and if they're taking aspirin to control that pain, oh, what does aspirin do? What can aspirin be used for? Yeah, quote-unquote blood thinner. In a physiology course, you'll learn that it really doesn't thin your blood, but it inhibits coagulation, right? So now this woman is really predisposed and set up to even more hemorrhage as a result of that, right? So what you should think about for your friends and yourself, and in terms of ectopic pregnancy, what are some things that you should be thinking about? Is the woman in childbearing years, right? Is she in that span of her life where she can become pregnant, right? Are you sexually active? If you're not sexually active, you don't have to worry about pregnancy, right? And do you have a history of pelvic inflammatory disease? And if all those things line up, yes, then that's something that probably should be ruled out because it's such a deadly occurrence when that happens. All right, so that's something about the fallopian tube and that ciliated surface, right? And that fallopian tube empties normally into the uterus. And we can see some layers of the uterus. The endometrium is the inner lining of the uterus. The big, thick muscle right here is the myometrium. And then there's a connective tissue sheath that surrounds the whole uterus, and we call that the... So we got endo, myo, and perineurium. So peri means surrounding. I mean, not neurium, metrium, perimetrium. Okay. And so this is where pregnancy takes place. And then here is the cervix. The cervix is a very powerful, smooth muscle which closes during gestation so that the fetus doesn't slip out. It holds the fetus there for about 9 months. And the cervix is a dome-shaped structure, and the edges of that dome, right, we call the fornices. So I can see here see the anterior fornix, the posterior fornix, but there are two lateral fornices as well. Right, and that just kind of defines what the dome of the cervix is. And the cervical canal goes through the cervix from the lumen of the uterus. All right, then down over here we have the vagina, another smooth muscle wall that accepts the penis for intromission and receiving ejaculate for fertilization. And it is smooth muscle as well. And I just thought of an interesting question. What do you think the strongest muscle in the human body is? Who are you thinking about right now? Probably you're thinking of this guy that was our governor at one time. Who was that? Arnold Schwarzenegger, right? He had these big, huge, bulging muscles, big, huge, you know, he'd flex his biceps and he'd almost give himself a black eye, right? Because it was such a big muscle. All right, so what do you think the strongest muscle is in the body? Strongest muscle in the body. Say that again. How about a biceps, like if it was Arnold Schwarzenegger's bicep, or his, maybe his deltoid, that he can't, what does that deltoid do? It abducts, right? It allows you to lift your arm up, all right? So those are pretty strong muscles, but you think those are the strongest muscles in the body, and you got to say no, right? And you have to be impressed with this cervix right here. Right, the cervix right here has got to stay contracted for how many months? 9 months, right? And then day after day after day, near term, right? The fetus could be anywhere from, well, 7 pounds typically up to 9, 10 pounds. Can Arnold Schwarzenegger or the strongest man or woman in the world take a 10-pound weight and abduct it and hold it there for 9 months? There is no way, not even close, right? So what do you think the strongest muscle in the human body is? It's got to be the cervix, right? It's got to be the cervix. Okay, that's just sort of an interesting thought that I just had. Okay, so here is the opening of the reproductive tract. So here is the orifice of the reproductive tract. Here is the urinary bladder and the urethra in the female. And notice that they never join together, right? So urinary tract infections, right, don't easily move into the reproductive tract, and that's really important because that would produce what, a pelvic inflammatory disease, and that would predispose that woman to ectopic pregnancies, right? So these two tracts are always different from each other. Here is Bartholin's gland, sort of like the analog to the vulvo-urethral gland in the male, secretes mucus. Here's the clitoris, erectile tissue, kind of the analog of the male penis, right? But notice the urethra doesn't go through it. And then this compartment right here is what we call the vestibule. And the vestibule contains the Bartholin's gland, clitoris, as well as some folds of skin, right, that we call labia. Right, and so here is the minorum and here is the majorum, and that just protects the urethra and vagina from infection. And so that's what their job is. So this right here, this is just what we call the vestibule. All right, nice sagittal section. And here is a coronal section. I'm sure both of these, were both of these exam figures? I think so. Yeah, I hope so. All right, so here is another view of the female reproductive system. Here we can see the ovary, and we can see some different stages of maturation of a follicle that will produce an oocyte. Here are some very immature, right? And so all of this doesn't happen in an ovary all at one time, but if we were to think about many months, right, that we would see things like this. We're going to go over some of these structures in just a little bit. The uterus, we can see the three layers very nicely. All right, here's the fundus of the uterus, which is like the superior broad end. What does that remind you of? Where have you run into fundus before? Stomach. What part of the stomach is the fundus? Where would you find it? Describe where you'd find the fundus or fundic region of the stomach. Top part, superior part. Would it be above the opening of the esophagus into the stomach? We call that the cardiac region, or kind of in that same area? Above the cardiac region. Yeah, you got to know that, right? So same thing right here. Look at the lumen of the uterus. It's what? Superior to where the fallopian tubes attach to it, right? That's superior. That's the fundus. Okay. All right, so here's that nice fallopian tube. Notice it doesn't have strong muscle layers to it, not strong like the uterus. This is a fimbriated edge of the fallopian tube, and this fimbriated edge has some smooth muscle as well as a ciliated surface. And you could think of that as like somebody's hand with fingers. Since they have smooth muscles, they're sweeping over the surface of the ovaries all the time, trying to capture that ovulated egg, right, during ovulation. So they're moving around, trying to capture that egg, right, and then the ciliated surface moves it through the infundibulum, then here's the ampule of the fallopian tube all the way down. Oh, and then here's a little narrowing of the fallopian tube, right, that we call the isthmus. So an isthmus is just a narrowing of something, and here it is in a fallopian tube. And of course, we certainly don't want it so narrow, right, that it prevents the movement of that oocyte, right, into the uterus, or a fertilized egg into the uterus. Right, and if there's a lot of pelvic inflammatory disease, then you can have scar tissue building up here, and then that would set somebody up to having a pregnancy in a fallopian tube. All right, so here we see the cervix once again, and the cervical canal. The openings of that cervical canal right here, we have the internal os, and then over here we have the external os. And then we see the fornices. We see the lateral fornices right here helping make the dome of the cervix. All right, let's look at some ligaments. We have fallopian tube, we have ovary and uterus. They are all connected together with something that we call the broad ligament that holds all of these structures in place. Right? There are some specializations of the broad ligament, especially a connection between the uterus and the ovary. We call that the ovarian ligament, right? And then there is a round ligament. And here is the round ligament that goes from the wall of the pelvic cavity over to the uterus. All of these are components of the broad ligament, but I'm not going to ask you about the mesosalpinx or the mesoovarium, the mesometrium. All right, so we don't have, you don't have to know that bit of detail, but you should at least know the ovarian ligament, round ligament, and broad ligament.
Okay, there was something that I wanted to mention right here.
Ah, this is what I wanted to mention to you. Especially you can relate this to ectopic pregnancies. Well, when you look at this fallopian tube with this very broad region over here and kind of a narrow region here by the isthmus, that should remind you of a musical instrument. What musical instrument does this, and it look at it over here, what musical instrument does that remind you of? Anybody have an idea what musical instrument that reminds you of? What does it remind you of? No thoughts? Okay. Yeah, maybe you think of, well, maybe if it was just a straight tube, it could be a clarinet. Right here is the opening of the clarinet, then the mouthpiece right here, a nice clarinet. But, you know, way back when, trumpets were just straight. They weren't all coiled up. And when people were doing dissections and investigating the reproductive tract in humans, this reminded somebody of a trumpet way back when, right? So here is the flared opening of the trumpet. Here's the mouthpiece over here. And another name for trumpet is salpinx. It's a really weird word, salpinx, right? And yeah, and so that's why this one right here is called the mesosalpinx. But here's where you might run into it. When somebody has scar tissue of the fallopian tube, which predisposes them to infertility and ectopic pregnancies, sometimes we would like to get a picture of the tube, of the salpinx, right here, to see if it is patent or if there are blockages. And that picture is called a hysterosalpingogram. Hysterosalpingogram. Where does that word salpingogram come from? Salpinx, which is really the anatomical view of what this fallopian tube looks like. Hystero refers to the uterus, so you get a picture of the lumen of the uterus. That should be nice and continuous with the lumen of the fallopian tube, right? So that would demonstrate blockages within the reproductive tract. Right, hysterosalpingogram would be the picture that you get. All right, so what's another name for trumpet? Salpinx, yeah, salpinx, right? And a hysterosalpingogram is just a picture of the inside lumen of the fallopian tube and uterus right here, looking for scar tissue. And what do we call a tube that is open? I've mentioned this to some people, but I want to go over it once again. And we looked at it in terms of the foramen ovale. Where do you have the foramen ovale at? In the heart, yeah. So it's an opening between the right and left atrium, right? Because that's a hole. It's a passageway for blood of a fetus. And if that hole is open, say maybe even in the adult, what do we call it? When a tube is open or that hole, that foramen hasn't scarred over, hasn't closed. What do we call something when blood can flow through it or maybe through that?
It is called patent, right? If something is open, it's patent. Like a patent foramen ovale is when the foramen ovale hasn't closed over in the adult, so there's blood leaking from the right and left, right?
If a blood vessel has a lot of arteriosclerosis and it's occluded, then it is no longer a patent. So we're interested in tubes that should be open. They're patent. That's a good thing, right? The foramen ovale, if it's patent in the adult, that's a bad thing, but at least we need to know how to talk about it. All right, so what about this fallopian tube, right? That hysterosalpingogram will demonstrate if it is patent or not. And if it's patent, is that a good thing? Yes, that means that it's open, right? It's not occluded, and that reduces the chance of ectopic pregnancy. All right, so patency is what we're investigating there. Okay. All right, what else for the reproductive system? I think that's pretty much about it. Oh, it's not. I got to show you some things that will help you answer some questions at the end of the chapter. All right, so here is a really important figure for you and for me. And unfortunately, it's not a picture that you find in your textbook. Okay, but here it is.
All right, that might look a little complicated, but this kind of ties a lot of things of what we learned in this class together. All right, so it's a graph. It's an illustration, but it's also a graph. And when you look at a graph, what are the first things that you should look for before you get confused? When somebody gives you a graph, the first things you should look for are the axes and how they are labeled. All right, so on the horizontal axis, we just have time, days, 1 through 28. Right, and same for the top and bottom graphs over here, 1 through 28. And so this is the typical cycle length of a menstrual cycle in a woman during childbearing years. All right, so the top graph, we have gonadotropins versus that same period of time. And what are some gonadotropins? You learned about FSH and LH. These cause, because FSH is follicle stimulating hormone, LH is called luteinizing hormone. We're going to look and see what the major effects are of these two hormones. Well, you should know where they come from. Maybe on this figure you should label, where does FSH and LH come from? Pituitary gland? Absolutely. As a matter of fact, the anterior pituitary, right? These are both called gonadotropins, right? Together they're gonadotropins. But individually, FSH and LH, and they influence the ovarian cycle. So what organ are we interested in? What are we concerned about when we talk about FSH and LH if they help control the ovarian cycle? What organ? Yeah, the ovaries, right? The ovaries. So let's take a look. So FSH, right, is relatively high. Okay, at the beginning of the ovarian cycle, like on day one, starts to decrease a little bit, but not very much, right? And so what's the job of FSH? We call it follicle stimulating hormone, right? Well, if we look inside the ovary, we can see a bunch of these supercells that we call follicles. And inside every follicle is, an oocyte, right? And follicle stimulating hormone helps these follicles to mature. Right, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. Maybe there's three or four of them, right? And eventually one reaches maturation right on day 14, and then what happens to the follicle? It spits out an egg, right? Ovulation takes place. All right, so what hormone peaks the most and triggers ovulation? Well, you could go to the graph and you can look and you can see, here it is, LH, luteinizing hormone, right? There's this big spike and luteinizing hormone. So if you're going to think about these two hormones from the pituitary gland, you would say FSH promotes oocyte maturation or follicle maturation, and LH will cause ovulation. Okay. All right, so those are just two bullet points. All right, after ovulation, that follicle doesn't degenerate. It becomes another very important endocrine organ in the ovary. It doesn't leave the ovary. Of course, this oocyte leaves the ovary, but the follicle, the remnant of the follicle, becomes something we call the corpus luteum. Corpus luteum. And I can see it right here. It no longer has an oocyte. And the corpus luteum is important because it helps maintain the uterus, the lining of the uterus, namely the endometrium. Right? And it grows and it grows and it grows. And if implantation does not take place, then the corpus luteum degenerates and no longer has any influence. But if implantation does take place, then the corpus luteum stays healthy and viable, and then the endometrium will stay healthy and viable for maintaining that pregnancy. All right, so here we have follicles. So this is what we call the follicular phase of the ovarian cycle. Right at mid-cycle we have ovulation. Following ovulation we have the luteal phase, because what's the organelle, or not organelle, what's the organ, right, that we have inside the ovary in the luteal phase? It's called the corpus luteum. All right, so let's look down at this next graph. A follicle, a developing follicle, is mostly responsible for secreting estrogen. The corpus luteum is mostly responsible for secreting what? Progesterone. Progesterone. So a good question could be, where does estrogen come from? You could say ovary, but you'd want to say a developing follicle. And where does progesterone come from? If you just had to pick one thing, you would say the
corpus luteum. All right, so let's look and see what the effects of estrogen and progesterone are. All right, so that brings us to the uterus. And so now we're going to look at the menstrual cycle, right? Ovarian cycle has to do with events in an ovary. The menstrual cycle has to do with events in the uterus, right? Because it's the uterine cycle. All right, so here we have estrogen. Where is estrogen coming from? It's coming from a follicle in an ovary, right? And it's a hormone, so it goes into the blood. It causes maturation of the endometrium. And so blood vessels start to grow, some glands start to grow, right? And that it peaks right at ovulation, okay? And because that's the biggest follicle that we have. It doesn't cause ovulation, right? It's just the result of this growing follicle. And then after ovulation, it starts to regress, right? Estrogen starts to disappear. But look at that follicle. What does a follicle become? It transitions from a follicle to the corpus luteum, and the corpus job of the corpus luteum is now to start secreting progesterone, right? All right, so when you look at this term progesterone, I want you to understand its origin. What do we call that period of time when a woman is pregnant? What do we call that? We call that gestation, right? Typically 9 months for us, gestation. And so, what hormone is the highest during gestation? It is progesterone because it maintains the endometrium. So people call progesterone progestational hormone. Progestational, which means what? It promotes gestation by maintaining the endometrium. All right, so in this phase of the menstrual cycle, there are very high levels of progesterone, some high levels of estrogen that maintains the endometrium, right? So it produces a lot of vasculature, right? Growth of blood vessels into the endometrium, and it also causes maturation of glands. We're not really sure what these uterine glands do, but we presume that it has something to do in aiding with implantation. We're not exactly sure. Okay, and so progesterone is necessary for this endometrium to grow and maintain itself, but during pregnancy, progesterone also makes the next layer really quiet. Instead of contracting all the time, right, and that is what layer of the uterus has muscle? Myometrium, right? So progesterone, right, just kind of quiets the myometrium down so that the implanted embryo isn't expelled from the uterus. Those are all the jobs of progesterone. All right, so the menstrual cycle is broken down into three phases. All right, so right at the beginning of the menstrual cycle, the endometrium is growing, rapidly growing. We call that the proliferative phase. Proliferation is when mitosis is taking place very rapidly. A tissue is growing very, very rapidly. And in this proliferative phase, there are cells that are growing. What cells are growing? Where would you tell me these cells are proliferating? The endometrium. Yes, indeed, the endometrium. Right, then right at mid-cycle, okay, we see estrogen starting to decline. Progesterone is taking over. And the development of these uterine glands take place. So this is what we call the secretory phase, right, of the menstrual cycle. And if you don't like that term menstrual cycle, you could say, as a matter of fact, I like probably uterine cycle a little bit better, right? Because we're talking about a structure on the top ovary. If we want to talk about a structure on the bottom right here, you could say uterine cycle, right? Uterine cycle and menstrual cycle sometimes are used synonymously. All right, and if implantation doesn't take place, the corpus luteum starts to degenerates, progesterone levels start to decrease, as well as estrogen, and that signals the period of menstruation. All right, so day one, it's the first day of menstrual flow from the uterus. All right, and then that cycle repeats itself over and over and over again. So proliferative phase is part of the uterine or menstrual cycle. It's a result of estrogen from a follicle. It causes proliferation of the endometrium, right? So hence we call that the proliferative phase. And then after ovulation, the follicle disappears, but it becomes the corpus luteum secreting progesterone. and it causes maturation of these glands, uterine glands, and so we call that the secretory phase of the uterine or menstrual cycle. And then if implantation does not take place, the corpus luteum disappears, starts to regress, and that signals, right, menstruation. All right, so then this layer of the endometrium is lost, right, and is flushed out with that mild hemorrhage out of the uterus. Okay, but what can also happen to some women with these cells? Right? Usually they're washed out of the person's body, but what else can happen to some of these endometrial cells? Well, what is their nature? Their nature is to proliferate, right? To grow very rapidly during the proliferative phase, right? And then regress. Well, if any of these cells, right, instead of moving from the uterus out the vagina, if they move retrograde through a fallopian tube into an abdominal or pelvic cavity, guess what they can do? Right? They can proliferate. Right? They can start to grow in mesentery or the walls of intestines or on the outside wall of a fallopian tube or on the outside wall of the uterus, right? Once a month, and then they regress. Right? And then they start to grow again. So that almost kind of looks like cancer, because here are cells that have moved from the uterus into the pelvic and abdominal cavity and they start to grow. That almost sounds like cancer, right? But it's not really quite cancer, because these cells can never leave the pelvic and abdominal cavity, right? And then they regress every month and then they start to grow again. So it's not really like cancer, but it's a very uncomfortable circumstance for the woman. Produces a lot of inflammation and a lot of discomfort. And what do we call that abnormal condition? When these endometrial cells start to grow in places other than the uterus, like mesentery, for instance. That is endometriosis, right? Endometriosis is just the proliferation of these endometrial cells outside of the uterus. And I'm not an expert with this, but I would guess after menopause, right, then I would hope that that condition disappears. And I would guess that it certainly is much better for most women. But some women, it's really a nasty process to go through, and they might actually elect to have surgery to remove some of that tissue, right, to reduce that endometriosis and that pelvic and abdominal cavity. But what's one of the side effects of surgery? Is scar tissue, right? So endometriosis produces scar tissue, and the treatment then will produce scar tissue as well. So it's a balance that it's a judgment call that has to be made by the individual woman and her physicians, okay, to know if that would be helpful or not. All right, so here is an important figure. Do you see the ovarian cycle and uterine cycle? What are the four hormones that are important? Estrogen and progesterone, as well as LH and FSH, right? And you should know where does estrogen come from if you're just going to pick one place? The follicle inside an ovary. Where does progesterone come from? Corpus luteum inside an ovary. Where does FSH come from? Anterior pituitary. Where does LH come from? Anterior pituitary. What does LH cause? Ovulation. What does FSH cause? Maturation of a follicle, right? Prepares it for ovulation. All right, and then you should have some understanding of what estrogen and progesterone are for. All right, and we're almost done. We got 3 minutes left in class. Nobody is asking me, well, what happens if implantation does take place? Okay, we see decreasing levels of progesterone if implantation does take place. What maintains that pregnancy? Because here I see the natural tendency is to decrease, a rapid decrease in progesterone and loss of the endometrium if implantation takes place. You don't want that to happen. What is going on there? Okay, there's something that has to maintain progesterone, right? And so there is a signal that comes from the placenta. Right, and a placenta is really interesting tissue, because it's the only tissue I'm really aware of that's made from two different people. It's part maternal tissue, part fetal tissue that come together to perform a function when part of that placenta secretes human chorionic gonadotropin, HCG. Maybe that kind of rings a bell for some of you, HCG. That is what's used in a pregnancy test, right? So that can be measured, right, with a urine test. And that placenta secretes human chorionic gonadotropin, and HCG goes to the corpus luteum and says, don't go away. Stay viable, right? Keep secreting progesterone because I'm here. The placenta is here, right? So that's what happens. HCG is secreted by the placenta, maintains the corpus luteum. And what does the corpus luteum secrete? Progestational hormone. And that maintains that pregnancy. Okay, and then later on, the placenta is big enough to secrete enough progesterone all by itself to maintain the endometrium later on. So HCG is not necessary every day, but HCG, you know, if you're at high risk for ectopic pregnancy, it's not something that you really have to worry about because HCG is really easy to measure, and if you have implantation, that's when HCG is produced. And what about the day after that? What about HCG? What should be the levels of HCG? It should increase. And what about the day after that? Increase. And what about the day after that? Increase. Very easy to measure. But what happens if HCG increases, and then all of a sudden starts to decrease? What does that mean? That means that you have stress or death occurring in that implantation, right? So it's very easy to track to see what's happening with that implantation. Right, so if you have that history of pelvic inflammatory disease, maybe your OBGYN would want to measure levels of human chorionic gonadotropin fairly frequently just to make sure that you don't have an ectopic pregnancy. All right, sign-in sheet is going around. What did I forget to talk about? Question. Here's a good question. Spermatogenesis?
Only if there is a question at the end of the chapter or an online question that I have for you for spermatogenesis. Okay?
I think there are some questions about that, like my physics.
Yeah, there's probably a couple of questions. There's probably a couple. Not to ignore, but the important one is this figure right here because it tells you how to understand all of these different hormones and what the effect of they have on the ovary and the uterus. Okay? So ovarian cycle and uterine cycle.
Yes, you certainly can. You don't have this in your study guide? No, then it's not an exam figure. But I'm sure there's questions at the end of the chapter that you would like to have this picture in your mind. And I sure would like maybe to send this picture to you guys.